Today is Saturday, September 2nd, 2023. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Hontoon. Peter spells his name, common spelling for Peter, P-E-T-E-R, last name, H-O-N-T-O-O-N.
U-N.
H-U-N-T-O-O-N. Yeah, is that right, Peter?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, make correction here. And my name is Tom Martin. Peter, thank you so very much for your willingness to let us interview you today. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Peter, what year were you born?
1942.
And where were you born?
A place called West Orange, New Jersey.
Where is West Orange?
25 miles straight west of New York City. It's a suburban bedroom community for Newark and New York City.
Okay. Is the ocean nearby?
No, we're inland.
Okay, all right. What were your parents doing out there at West Orange?
Well, I was, my parents were divorced when I was about six, so I was being raised by my mother, and I had an older brother. So we were just living in the suburban town.
Okay. Do you know how your mom met your dad?
I have no idea.
Okay. And this is in 1942, so it was just before, you know, America, and it was during World War II.
Yeah, my father didn't serve in the Army, so I don't know anything about it.
Okay. All right. And did you have other brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had a brother named Perry who's 4 years older.
Okay. So this would have been 1948 that your parents got divorced. What did your mom do? She had two children. She was trying to raise these kids?
Yeah, no, she didn't work. Her health wasn't great.
Okay. So did your older brother, you know, get to work right away to help make ends meet for the family, and did you?
No, what happened fortuitously, my grandfather came to live with us, and he lived with us until I was about, till 1954. That's when he died, so he lived with us there.
Okay. What was his name?
A guy named John Clemen, spelled with a K.
K-L-E-M-M-E-N-S?
Right.
What was your mother's name?
Mary.
Okay. And your father?
Perry.
Okay. So your elder brother's name...
Yeah, he was the junior.
Okay. All right. What was growing up in West Orange like?
Well, it was very typical suburban bedroom community. Most of the men in my neighborhood worked in Newark in one of the high-rise insurance companies down there.
Okay.
And this neighborhood was sort of semi-rural. It was a suburban development that had been put in years before through farmland. So there's a lot of open space around us. So it's a nice, comfortable place to be raised.
Okay. Did you like outdoor kind of stuff? Did you get a chance to like go camping or do things like that?
Well, nothing like that. But I really roamed all over the place, and I was. We had lots of woods nearby, so I spent most of my time outdoors.
Okay.
And that was a big deal for me.
What was high school like?
Uneventful, uninteresting for me.
Okay. Did you get a chance in high school to sort of expand your local area horizons? Did you get into ornithology at all, or biology, you know, geology? Was there anything about your traveling around in this, really, it sounds like a sort of farm country?
Well, I had wanderlust, and the big deal for me was the summers. I spent them in the southern Catskill Mountains at my family's farm, and I used to go up there and work for 3 months in the summer. And that was a farm, so I got to do all the things you do on a farm, making hay and all that kind of stuff in the summer. The one thing I did when I was down in New Jersey was I rode my bike all over the place. And once I got old enough, I started hitchhiking all over the place. So I was always getting around. That was a big thing for me to get out and see new places. And
so who had the farm in the family?
Well, that was my great-grandparents' farm.
Okay.
And so it was just the old homestead for the family.
And who was working it?
One of my mother's cousins, her first cousin.
Okay.
And what they used to do is, as us younger cousins started to get to the teenage years,
mm-hmm.
Oftentimes the family that had us would farm us out up there to help out for the summer. And that's exactly the way it worked. So we were up there trying to help subsidize the operation.
Yeah. What was your earliest recollections of that place? And so this is in the Catskills. Can you kind of describe the landscape for me? Because I know that for nothing.
Well, the Catskills are a low mountain area that's adjacent to Kingston, New York. And it's got nice valleys in between, and people used to farm them. And then what happened was the New York City acquired that as a watershed for the city of New York. That was back in the 20s.
Okay.
And ever since then, they were trying to get the people out of there so that they could bring it back to woods. And gradually, it turned out to be a terrific wilderness area.
Wow.
But it had all these resort hotels in it. People from New York City used to go up there and stay at these resorts. So these resorts, they kind of dotted the southern Catskills, and the farming was kind of going out, and the place was returning to the woods. It was a great place to be. But anyway, I was in there during the transition, the last of the transition of that.
So one of the last holdout farms then in the area.
Yeah, they were starved out. That's what literally happened.
Really? How can you open that up a little bit for me? Tell me. I know nothing about this.
Well, what happened was is that initially the city of New York tried to buy everybody out, and then the holdouts were left behind. And for example, a lot of these places were dairy farms.
Yes.
Well, as the farm economy started to collapse, pretty soon you didn't have people there to pick up the milk and things like that, and the people just got starved out. And by that time, this would be in the late 40s, early 50s, these places started to turn into art communities, and one of them best known is a place called Woodstock, which was just 4 miles down the road from where I lived.
Okay.
And wealthy people from New York started buying up these parcels and making summer homes there. So the place really got kind of gentrified in that way, and the small folks got squeezed out.
Yeah. And that happened to your family's...
That was real typical.
Wow. So what... Were your cousins running dairy cattle?
No, they had a general farm. They had a little of everything. They had a few cows, a bunch of sheep, and then... My cousin made custom corn cutting in the fall for people, so he would travel all over that area and harvest their corn for them.
Did you get in on that?
No, I was in school at that time.
Okay, all right. And what are some of the one or two of the really fun memories you have of that time working on the farm?
Well, the big thing for me was I love driving the equipment, trucks and the tractors and that, so I kind of live for that. But the thing that was really memorable about it in terms of retrospect is that these small farmers had to be able to do anything, and you acquire that. It's the idea that you're sitting there and something breaks down or something goes wrong, you've got to fix it, and you become a jack-of-all-trades, and I just simply picked that up. And that's absolutely invaluable for a young guy.
Yes. Nice. I'm just thinking maybe there was a welder, you got proximity to that maybe, or just, you know, how to fix a carburetor that's, you know, sticking, or you know, tear down a transmission, or a, or fix a flat tire?
Well, you know, whatever you had to do.
Okay.
Now, I'll tell you one thing that was interesting. The Catskills are in the lower Permian. That's the rocks they're developed in.
Okay.
And so there were, I'd find fossils around there.
Oh.
And the thing I was finding was brachiopods and things like that in the silts. And that was a real thrill for me when I found a fossil. And when I was about 10, we went up to the State Museum in Albany, and they had a fabulous paleontological museum up there. And somehow we had some cousins that lived a couple of blocks from this thing. So they went to visit the cousins. I went over to this museum by myself, and I'm wandering through these halls with all these fossils. And I'd been finding these things, and I mean, I was absolutely blown away by all this. So we go back to the farm. Well, the farm is 100 miles from this place. And all I could think about was those fossils. And they were, at the time, they had just finished building the New York State Thruway up to Albany from New York City. And that was about 15 or 20 miles from this farm. So one Saturday, I simply got down on a highway, didn't tell anybody where I was going. I got down the highway, and I hitchhiked up to the museum and spent the day there, hitchhiked back, got to the farm, never told anybody a thing. It was a great day.
And you were 10 years old?
Well, I was about 12 at the time.
Okay. Wow.
But I was, you know, I was going, one thing that was, I was very fortunate in that I had a very permissive mother, and she simply didn't hover, and she didn't try to constrain me. She was very patient with this kind of thing. So I didn't have problems with discipline if I went away for a while.
So it seems like she wasn't just permissive or patient. Was she encouraging?
She was very encouraging about anything intellectual.
Nice.
That was it. But in terms of my wanderlust, I don't know how she felt about that.
Well, she didn't ground you, it sounds like.
No, she was fine.
What was her upbringing like? How did she? I mean, that's sort of a visionary, or maybe it wasn't, Peter. What was? It's going to tell me more about your mom and why she was that way.
Well, I think she was one of these, she was a free-spirited, very intelligent woman, and she was well-educated, and, for example, she took French all her life, and she could get around and with French, and she traveled as a young girl to France and things like that.
Mm.
So this idea of not being cloistered in a, you know, a little suburban house wasn't her thing at all.
Did she go to advanced schooling? Did she get a college degree?
Yeah, she went down to what's the woman's thing equivalent to Rutgers? There's a woman's college down there that was a sister college to Rutgers.
Okay.
Not Rutgers. The one in New Jersey. Can't remember the name of it. But anyway, that's where she went.
So she definitely would have valued education.
Yeah, she had a good education.
Nice. And so anyway, she saw you getting that. It sounds like she was encouraging.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. Did you, when you mentioned road cut, you know, or this road that was going in, I'm thinking, wow, I wonder if there were fossils on the road cut spoils there. So at 12, you were heading out to this museum to look at the fossils there on your own. Where did that go into your early teens then, 13, 14?
Well, the big deal was I collected these things, and then my poor mother would have to put them in a car, and we'd haul them back to New Jersey, and I sprinkled them around the yard, and that was kind of the end of them.
Okay.
That was just an early fascination I had with rocks. You know, I didn't realize this was ever going to turn into anything.
Got it.
But that was, that was my first introduction to geology.
Okay. So you're being introduced to geology. You're learning a ton of skills on the farm in the summer. Was that a paying gig for you, or was that just a sweat equity gig? It's kind of journey.
Oh, no, it was absolutely, it was the highlight of my life.
Wow.
Yeah, that kind of stuff was just a highlight of my life. I wasn't a very good student. I didn't read well at all.
Okay. Did that reflect in your grades then?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, I had rather mediocre grades.
Okay. Where'd you graduate from high school?
Well, what happened in 59, we moved out to Tucson.
Whoa!
Wait.
You just dropped me off a cliff there. What precipitated that move from kind of really nice New Jersey, green, you know, leaves changing in the fall, farm, moving to Tucson's like going to another planet?
Well, there's a couple of things here. I can tell you about why we did it, but what the impact on me was just revolutionary.
Well, wait. Let's talk about why you did it first.
Well, the reason we went out there was my mother had very bad arthritis.
Oh.
And she wasn't going to last long in New Jersey.
Okay.
So, the recommendation was go to Tucson, you know, and the climate's good for you.
Had her father passed away by then?
Oh, yeah, he's gone.
Okay.
He's long gone. This
All
is
right.
59.
Okay.
And so she simply pulled the plug and sold the house, and we moved out to Tucson. Now, at that time, it was me and her going to this new place. My brother was just getting in the Army, so he wasn't a factor, although he and I drove out there.
Okay.
But the idea was, it was the two of us. We went out, and she went out there and bought this house.
How did your mom get out? Did she fly out?
I don't remember. I think she must have flown, yeah.
So wait a second now. Let's talk about this road trip you and Perry did. This is 1959. What kind of vehicle did you have? Do you remember?
Well, we had this Ford, and we simply packed up some of the stuff and drove out.
Like a Ford four-door kind of thing? Big, clunky thing?
Yeah, we came across pretty much on Highway 30 through the Midwest, and got to Lincoln, Nebraska, dropped down into Kansas, and then drove straight across Kansas to Denver, and then down 285 to Santa Fe, and over to Tucson. So anyway, we got to the end. It was the first time we were ever west.
What was that drive like for you?
That was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, because once I got past Iowa, it was out in the plains and all that, and it was culture shock. You know, the vast expanses of Kansas really, really had an impact on me. And the other thing I remember is once we dropped into New Mexico, we came down through Santa Fe, and then we did a little stint on 66. And to see the Native American communities, I thought I was in another country.
Wow.
I just, you know, it was really mind expanding, to say the least.
Okay.
And then once we arrived in Tucson, I was in a totally new geographic and cultural environment.
You would have been, hang on a second, let me work out the timeline. 42, 52, you were 10, 62, you'd be 20, this is 59. So had you just graduated from high school?
No, I still had 2 years to go.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
Whoa,
yeah.
So new school, new turf.
Yeah, but the thing that was really interesting about it was I wasn't very, very complacent in New Jersey. And what I discovered years later was, you know, that was a place with trees, with canopies across the road.
Yep.
And gray skies, a lot of rain.
Mm.
And it was kind of claustrophobic for me, although, you know, I couldn't articulate that. But it was an interesting experience. Once I got to Tucson, it was like an entirely new day. Everything was, it just looked like the land opportunity to me.
Wow.
It was just a night and day difference. Everything changed. My grades improved. My outlook on life improved. My goals started to expand. And, you know, of course, this traveling woke me up a little bit.
Nice.
But I remember it took about... this is curious. It took about 3 or 4 months for me to adjust. We were living in Tucson, and I'd never thought about this, but I considered at that point in my life that New York was the center of the world. Okay. I mean, somehow you just get these ideas.
Yeah.
And now I was, you know, 2,500 miles away from New York. I felt like I was really out in the boondocks and lost.
Wow.
And this was a very curious thing, but this is very real. And this lasted for about 3 months, 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
And one day my mother wanted to get out for a ride, so we took off from Tucson, went over the Rincon Mountains to the east and down the San Pedro River.
Yeah.
And, of course, this put us out on dirt
roads. Wait, yeah, I was going to say, this is over Reddington Pass?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it. That would have been a dirt road.
Oh, it was a lousy road.
Oh, my.
But she was game, and we had this Ford that cleared the thing, so that was
okay.
Fun.
And so we got over. The San Pedro drops you down into rural ranch land.
There's nothing there.
Yeah. There should be some water in the river.
Yeah.
But,
and you know, the thing that was neat was there was nobody there. The roads were absolutely lousy.
Yeah.
And we started down towards,
Toward Benson or?
Yeah, Benson. We came out at Benson.
All right.
And we're on this road. We're driving down at Benson. And all of a sudden, it hit me. New York isn't the center of the world.
Oh, wow.
The center of the world is where you are.
Wow.
And as soon as that happened, the fog lifted. From then on, it was no going back east, let me tell you.
Wow.
And it was, it was, okay, the center moves with you. That's where it is.
Let me
back. It was kind of an awakening.
Peter,
I guess everybody has it, but it happened to me just overnight. It was me. And I was completely comfortable after that.
Let's back up a little bit. Where was the house you guys settled in Tucson?
Well, it was a place... Juanita Street. It was near Grant and Campbell Avenue, which now is really kind of downtown.
Right, right. Was that on the kind of the north side of town? Was there like acres of creosote off to the north of you toward the Catalinas? Or?
Well, we were stuck right in the middle of this big suburban sprawl.
Okay.
But the edge of town was a couple of miles to the north.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, Rolito Rush went by there about 2 miles away.
Yeah. Okay.
Which was great. I mean, everything was great.
How did your mom's health change with the move?
Oh, it turned her around. She got several years out of it.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, that was the best thing that ever happened to her for her health.
And then did you go to Tucson High School? Where'd you go to school?
I went to a place called Catalina, which was only a couple of years old at the time.
Okay.
And that was, that was one of these amazing turnaround experiences. When I was in West Orange, of course, everybody was in college prep classes. When I got to this Catalina, they had a good shop program.
Cool.
And so what I started doing is I gravitated towards the shops, and I was taking a lot of welding and machine shop and stuff like that. And the last year I was there, I took 2 academic courses a semester, and all the rest were shop courses. And so I was doing a lot of welding and stuff like that. Now, you have to understand that fit right in with what I was doing on the farm before.
Right.
And this was all really good. What it gave me was an intellectual break from the classic New Jersey grow up to be a middle-class guy and go to some office building somewhere.
Mm.
I got away from that. And that's what it did for me.
Nice. So you graduated from Catalina in 61, 62?
Yeah, it must have been 61, 62.
Okay. As a senior in high school, was your mom saying anything about college? Was she saying when you go to college? Was college expected of you?
Well, that was an expectation. And that was sort of an anchor, but I wasn't at all interested in that. I was I was kind of adrift. I was thinking about maybe I join the Navy or something like that. You know, that kind of thing.
What service did Perry join?
Well, he was in the Army.
Okay.
Yeah, and he joined. He didn't get drafted, so he was in for 4 years.
Okay.
But by now he was in, he was back in the East and in some base around Virginia.
Okay.
So he was out of my life.
Did he just go through his tour And then step out, or did he career with the service?
What's that?
Did he career with the service, or did he just go through his...
No, as soon as he graduated, he came out to Tucson and went to the University of Arizona.
Oh.
Yeah, he did real well.
Great. What did he go through, that was the University of Arizona there?
Well, he got in a business program, and he was real interested in transportation.
Hmm.
And so what he ended up doing was studying transportation. He got offers from the railroads, but they weren't doing too hot. And what he ended up doing was going to work for Shell and in Houston. And from there, he went on and got a law degree at night, went to became a right-of-way lawyer and spent a career with them.
Wow.
So he had a good life.
Huh. Okay.
But anyway, that's so.
So you mentioned hitchhiking, and you talked about when you were 12 hitchhiking on a day trip that nobody knew about, 100 miles out and 100 miles back. Did you keep that skill up before you came to Tucson? Were you doing more kind of journeying further afield?
Well, once I got to Tucson, I was old enough to get a license as soon as we got to Tucson.
Okay.
So I ended up with an old family car, which was this 56 Ford. And once I had that thing, my bicycle days were over. and the first thing I did, we were out in Tucson for the season. And the next summer, I thought, well, I'll go back to New Jersey and visit my old haunts and all that. And I jumped in the car and drove back to Jersey and stayed with my uncle, who lived right outside of New York, and got a job in his restaurant for the summer. And then I drove back, and I did that for two summers in a row, which was great because, you know, that allowed me to drive across the country and you know, flap my wings.
Yeah. What were you doing in the restaurant?
Oh, I had this grave shift job. I went to work at 5 till 2 in the morning in a place called Pal's Restaurant, which was a upscale restaurant in West Orange. And it was all I did was bus dishes for the counter out front where they had kind of a fast food place.
Okay,
that was a great experience. That thing helped shape me because, of course, that's a real low end job.
And right.
The people I was working with were these were good people, but they were the type of people that were working two jobs just to make ends meet. And I watched that, and I thought, okay, time to set your sights a little higher. You're going to college.
Interesting.
And that was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Okay.
So and, you know, I didn't make any money. You couldn't make any money at the job.
Right. Were you still in high school at that time, or was this?
Yeah. I was a sophomore and a junior in high school.
Holy cow, Peter. I mean, I just think this is really a big deal for a high school student to drive in the summer across the country and get a job, you know, bussing dishes, and then drive back to Tucson to go back to high school all by yourself. That's pretty cool.
Well, yeah, it was great. And, you know, what I'm doing, I'm soaking up the geography. It was great. But there were other things that come in. This is kind of fun. When I first got to Tucson, I was in this high school, and somehow I learned about this caving club that was formed down at the University of Arizona.
Ooh!
And this thing was called the Southwestern Speleological Society or Association, the SSA. And there was a fellow who put it together named George Beck. And he was a fellow from Pittsburgh that just came out there and happened that year to put this thing together. Well, I got wind of this thing. Well, I was always really interested in caves. They really, you know, I didn't know anything about them, but I was interested in the concept.
Okay.
So I went down there to this thing. Well, here you got college students, and in walks this junior in high school. And what was absolutely beyond belief was these people accepted me for some reason.
Cool.
And they tolerated me, and I was so gung-ho about all this that pretty soon I was just one of them. And I was the only high school kid that got involved in this thing. Anyway, we started caving around, too. I started caving with these people around Tucson.
Okay. So wait. Right there, I want to look at what we're doing for time. We are doing great for time. Can you please tell me your first recollections of George?
Of George?
George Beck.
Well, he was my senior by about 7 or 8 years, something like that.
Okay.
Maybe a little older. And yeah, he was an older fellow. And what had happened with George was he was an ardent caver in Pittsburgh. That's where he was from. And they used to do a lot of stuff down in West Virginia. Well, anyway, he got hold of an Arizona highways, and there was a photograph of Thunder Spring in this Arizona highways. And, you know, Thunder Spring is down in the Grand Canyon. And he looks at that, and he says, holy smokes, that's a gigantic cave. I got to go out there. So what happened was, is from Pittsburgh, he organized a couple of expeditions out to Thunder River, which was kind of a big deal, trying to do this from Pittsburgh.
In 1960, roughly, yeah.
Yeah, he was going out there in the 50s.
Oh, wow.
So he makes two trips out there, and they just can't get in the cave. They have bad luck. And on one trip, one of the guys came down with the mumps of all things.
Oh, gosh.
Right down at the bottom of the canyon.
Ugh.
They had to get that guy out. And on a second trip, they were doing a traverse underneath Thunder Falls.
Mm.
And the guy slipped and went sailing down the Bright Angel Shale. And the only thing between him and a 200-foot cliff going over the Tapete Sandstone was a barrel cactus. And he wraps his arm around the barrel cactus and stops. Well, anyway, they had to get him out of there.
Mm.
So the two trips ended up in failure. So what George did was he decided he couldn't do it from Pittsburgh. So what he does is he goes out and he enrolls in the University of Arizona.
Okay.
And that would have been 59.
Okay.
And he forms this club. And that's when I connect with a guy.
Okay.
So anyway, he's really skilled in all this kind of stuff. But he's got this Grand Canyon connection. And so at the end of that school year, Easter, those guys were going to go up to the Thunder River.
Okay.
And so that was my first trip to the Grand Canyon.
And, so this is Easter of 1959?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that would have been, 60. It would have been Easter 60, because I got there in 59. So
okay. This
is going to be the next year.
All right.
And so I went up there with them. And,
did you drive your car or did you ride with them?
Let's see. I had a car. Yeah, we took my car.
Okay.
Yeah, we
all
drove
right.
that out there.
That must have been helpful for those guys. Hey, here's a guy with a car, and he's willing to drive it.
Well, yeah, maybe that's why they tolerated me. I used my car once in a while.
Were you using carbide lanterns for getting around in caves at the time?
Yeah, we used carbide. I used that all my career.
Okay. All right. Did before you headed up to Thunder River in Easter of 1960, did you get into any of the other caves in the area surrounding Tucson?
Oh, yeah. I'd been all over the Huachucas and the Catalinas and the Chiricahuas. We did everything that was within reach. And there was one down in the Huachucas called Yorger Cave. It was a series of 200-foot, 220 feet of pits.
How do you spell that?
So I had all that experience behind me, you know. And
how do you spell that?
Yorger, J-O-E-R. Yeah, let me see.
G-E-R? Yorger?
Yeah, anyway, it's Yorger. I don't know how you spell
okay.
it.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, this thing had 250 feet of pits.
Hmm.
And
Gold Line, you learned about harnesses, little strap harnesses, and prussics, I'm assuming, for ascending, for climbing back out?
No, this guy came from West Virginia where they use cable ladder.
Oh!
And what I did is I made 500 feet of cable ladder.
Okay.
And then we had the belays with gold lines, so that's an old familiar term. But yeah, we were doing this on cable ladders, and I made all this cable ladder so we could go do this thing.
Fun.
George had some cable ladder, but he didn't have enough.
Okay.
So yeah, that was fun. So by the time we got to the Grand Canyon, you know, in terms of that technique stuff, I was those guys had seasoned me.
Hmm.
And you know, about four or five of us went down to Thunder River that first trip, and that was my introduction to the Grand Canyon, and that was another one of these amazing life-altering events. Boy, once I had seen that, that was no turning back from the Grand Canyon.
Okay, at that time, 1960, the Grand Canyon Enlargement Act hadn't happened, and you would have been on the Forest Service out to the top of the Thunder River Trail, which dropped you down onto the Esplanade, and then walked you a dozen miles or so along the Esplanade until you dropped down toward Cogswell Butte, and then to the east a little bit down to Thunder River. Is that kind of roughly how that journey would have gone?
Yeah, now you got that right. The route that you're talking about is the Thunder River Horse Trail that goes out of Little Saddle.
Yeah.
Now, the deal was, George had been stepping around there, you know, like I say, for a few years beforehand.
Okay.
He met a guy in Fredonia named Don Finnicum.
Okay.
And Don was a high school teacher in Fredonia, and he liked to go fishing, and this guy would go down and fish in Thunder River because the Park Service had stocked it decades before, back in the 40s, like in 49, they stocked it, so it had stuff in it. And so Don would go down there for the weekend. Well, what he had found, he went right off Monument Point and straight down Monument Point, and you dropped off Monument Point, walked around Bridger's Knoll, and then picked up the Thunder River Trail, so it made it only 8 miles.
Well, wait. So he is basically making what will become the Bill Hall Trail.
Yeah, except the Bill Hall Trail goes down to the Torreweep, and then it contours west to get down through the lower Torreweep and through the Coconino.
Okay.
And that adds a couple of miles.
Mm.
What Don did is he went straight down the nose to the top of the Coconino, where there was a real hairy move that you had to make, about a 200-foot drop.
Oops.
And then you dropped into the Supai, into the,
Hermit?
Yeah, the Hermit Shale.
Okay.
And then you went down past Bridger's Knoll.
Mm.
So it was a really great route. Well, George knew of this thing, so we went that way. And that was very important. So that cut off 4 miles. And got down to Thunder, dropped into Surprise Valley and went over the Thunder. And that's the way we got in there.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of people, are credited with getting these things pulled off. But that was the story of it.
So you guys are carrying your rope ladder and gold line and carbide lanterns and your sleeping stuff. That's a lot of weight.
Well, yeah, this was Thunder River was demanding. We had everything was in units of 6 pounds. You had 6 pounds of gold line. You had 6 pounds of cable ladder, and then we had one man life rafts that came out of these jets, and they weighed 6 pounds. And you had paddles. And so you had all this garbage, you know. So we were going down there pretty heavy.
Okay, so hang on a second. The Pete's Creek Thunder River Cave Complex has two large springs. One of those goes into an area where you definitely want a boat. The other one, not so much. Did George do his research enough? He clearly must have. If you guys are bringing boats, he must have known that was a requirement.
Well, he'd already gotten in the Thunder far enough to see that you needed a raft.
Okay, got it.
And so he was all geared up on that.
Okay.
And nobody had been in the Tapetes by that time.
Okay.
People had been in the entrance, but they hadn't been in the cave.
Got it.
And so nobody knew anything about the Tapetes.
Okay.
So when we got down there, we were going to be there for 5 or 6 days, something like that.
All right.
And we had to break it up into two trips because of the number of people, because we only had two rafts. So one day they went into Thunder with their, a couple of them went in Thunder, and I was left outside. So I hiked over to Tepeach to see what that was all about. I'd been hearing about that. And
okay.
So I walked into the entrance there, but I didn't get very far in.
Hmm.
And then I came back.
Okay.
And then the next day was my turn to go into Thunder. And,
so Thunder River has a fascinating entrance where you have to make this blind move of faith around this sheer edge. And
yeah, you go up the left side.
Yeah, and then you have to climb up into the mouth of this thing, which has a jet of water coming out of it with a small amount of room at the top, and everything's wet and slippery and loud. That was like, what were you thinking as you climbed in there?
Well, you know, I didn't know much about water caving. What I remember is once I got in the slots where the water is coming out, the big fear was falling down and getting washed out over the cliff.
Yes.
So, you know, I was very careful, let me tell you. But it wasn't that big a deal in terms of the technical climbing you had to do. And we got in there and got up in where the river ponds and inflated the rafts and simply went upstream. And you go for about, I don't know, about three-quarters of a mile from the entrance before it sumps on you.
Okay.
Now, the thing that was interesting this particular year is that it was, we got into there just as the last of the snow was melting on the Kaibab.
Oh.
And it was late spring. It was Easter. The first guys that went in got about a half a mile and it sumped. Got three-quarters of a mile and it sumped. The next day, it had sumped a quarter mile sooner.
Whoa.
So they were only able to get in there half a mile. So during that night, the water had come up. And all we ever thought of after that was, thank God we did it the way we did, because somebody would still be there.
No kidding.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had a real nice trip. It was a wonderful trip. And we got all over the area. But the objective George wanted, he wanted to get over to Tepeats.
Okay.
And we simply didn't have enough time to do it. I was the only one that got over there that particular trip to see it.
Okay.
And then I came back, so both of us had this burning desire to get back to Tepeats.
Okay.
Well, now... That winter, the following summer, George gets drafted into the Army, and he's off for 3 years. He ends up in Germany.
Okay.
So the following year, this club is still going, this Southwestern Speleological Association.
Okay.
And we organize another trip up there over Easter. So we go up there again for Easter. And the objective was to get over to Tepeats. Well, we never made it over to Tepeats that year either. So everybody's...
Why not? Because Thunder River kind of pulled people away, or what?
Well, yeah, we were just spending too much time there.
Huh.
Yeah, that's what was going on.
Okay.
And it just didn't happen. So now Beck has this burning desire to get back there. Of course, he's in Germany. I've got a burning desire to get back there and see Speed's Creek. So this sort of became this overall objective, is to get back to Tepeats. Well, George is in the Army. I end up going off to college at ASC up in Flagstaff, Arizona State College. And second year I was up there, he gets out of the Army. So the first thing we do is we organize a trip down to Tepeats, he and I and a couple of my buddies at Flagstaff.
Who are they?
So we go down there to Thunder River and
Peter, who was the team that went in? Who were your buddies from Flag?
Well, it was an interesting group. The memorable guy on that trip was a guy named Jim McCann, who turned out to be the sheriff at Flagstaff.
Okay.
And he retired from that position a couple of years ago. So everybody in Flagstaff knows Jim. And there were a couple other fellows that were along on a trip. I'd have to remember their names, but anyway, well, there were four or five of us. We got down there.
Okay.
And everybody stopped at Thunder and fooled around there. Well, George and I went over to Tepeats, and we got in, and we were the first people to push it beyond the entrance complex. And what we did, we went, it's a couple hundred feet in, and you get to the stream, you walk out of the side of a big tunnel, and the tube comes out of the side of this tunnel, you climb down, and there's a creek there, and you walk up the river. And so you get in there about a mile and a quarter or something like that. And George and I were going up the stream, and it was a very difficult go. The passage is about, I don't know, 60 or 80 feet wide, and both sides are lined with big blocks of breakdown with sand in between the blocks. And the blocks are just a little too big to comfortably walk up and try to stay on the sand and that kind of stuff. So you end up hiking up the creek, and it's about knee-deep to waist-deep in water, and it's coming at you like a minor rapid. And all I remember is walking and walking and walking, and finally we were looking up the passage, and all we could see was breakdown in front of us. It was blocked. And so we pushed towards that. We got to this breakdown, and we were both thinking, well, it's over. And once we got to the edge of this stuff, we looked up, and there was just enough room on the ceiling to get up above this stuff. And so we finally climbed out of the river and climbed up there. Well, that was the, that we got into a room that's 1,100 feet long.
Okay.
And it varies from about 75 to 120 feet wide, and you can't see the ceiling. It was something up there like 500 feet or so.
Wow.
Feet, something like that. I never did see the ceiling. But anyway, there were two mounds of breakdown in this thing. We walked across them, and then we were at the end of it. So we got to do this thing, and that was a big deal for us. George was very disappointed. He thought he was going to be walking up to Fredonia. And he was right, you know. I mean, that's where it came from.
Yeah.
But this is very interesting because this is I'm starting to learn some geology.
Okay.
George had figured out that these big springs, Tapeats, Thunder, and Deer Creek, were draining the west side of the Kaibab.
Okay.
And they were probably localized along the West Kaibab Fault Zone. And, of course, all this is Greek to me.
Okay.
But anyway, he had this kind of figured out.
Hmm.
And so now that we were done with Tapeats, the big objective was to go over to Deer Creek and see what that was about, because
okay.
he heard about Deer Creek and Dutton Spring up there.
Yeah.
So I was all hot to go on that, too. So eventually, in a year or two, we organized a trip over there, too, and got to that.
Okay. Let's back up a little bit. So you graduated from Catalina High School. You had already joined the Southwest Speleological Association group of cavers, and you were caving. As a newly minted high school graduate, clearly college would have been something to ponder. What were you? You know, you lived in Tucson. You had the U of A right there. How did you end up at Arizona State College in Flagstaff?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, this is kind of fun. I wasn't college bound, that clearly.
Okay.
But here I am in this Southwestern Speleological Association, and for 2 years in high school, I'm going caving with all these guys who are college students.
Okay.
And here all of a sudden I got, half a dozen role models in front of me.
Oh, wow.
You know, really, this is what we're talking about. Things, this was just preordained. So I'm starting to think, well, geez, if these guys can do it, I can probably do it, you know. But I really wasn't that hot on it, you know.
Okay.
And anyway, but the thing was, those guys, I'll tell you, I worship them because they allowed me to be part of their group, and what they're doing is they're bringing me up. And they're setting higher goals for me. So anyway, what happened was I had two shops that I was heavily involved in my high school. One was a machine shop, and the other was a welding shop. And the guy that ran the machine shop was a guy named Chambers, Guy Chambers. And the guy that ran the welding shop was a guy named James Aldous. And both of these guys were mentors. And so anyway, about about a month and a half before I graduated, their two shops are right next to each other.
Okay.
And in high school, you don't leave another shop. I mean, as a teacher, you don't even walk out of the class because the guys are going to go haywire and bust up stuff. So anyway, one day I was sitting there working on a lathe in Chambers' machine shop, and in walks Aldous. And I see him come in, and I know that this is absolutely something you don't do.
Mm.
He had left that class. And he and Chambers are talking for a minute, and they start heading my way. Well, Chambers just comes up, and he shuts off the lathe. He says, we need to talk. And they took me in a little side room that had the tools in it, and they shut the door. Now you got two classes out there that don't have guys.
Holy cow.
And I know that this is absolutely unprecedented.
Mm.
And the first thing that they did is Chambers kind of gently pushes me against the wall, and the two of them are right in my face, and Chambers says to me, well, what are you thinking about doing after you graduate? And I said, I'm going to join the Navy. And he says, we don't think that's such a hot idea. And I said, well, you know, at this point, I'm sitting wondering what the hell's going on. I sort of said, well, what do you have in mind? And one of them says, well, we think you ought to go to college.
And whoa.
I said, oh, well, that's nice. And then pretty soon it develops that this guy Chambers was in the Lions Club in Tucson. And what he'd done is he'd gone down there and arranged them to give me a little scholarship.
Whoa!
So he said, we got this little scholarship we're going to give you if you go. And I'm looking at the door. I'm trying to figure out how to get out of this situation. And I said, well, what do you got in mind? He said, well, we think you ought to go up to Arizona State College because they got an industrial arts program up there, and you could learn how to be a shop teacher. And I said, oh, yeah, that sounds good, you know. So they let me out of there. Well, in a couple of days, I got this letter offering me this little scholarship they'd put together.
Wow. How much was it?
I'm committed. You know?
How much was the scholarship?
Huh?
How much was it?
Oh, it was only $100 or $200, something like that, which was money back then.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I come back, you know, I come out of that deal, and I was talking to my mother. I said, hey, it looks like I'm going to Arizona State College. Well, she was absolutely delighted.
Nice.
So anyway, what happened was I graduated, I go up to ASC, and what I did is I formed a little caving group up there, a very informal thing.
Okay, wait. Let this back up just a little bit. You had already been up to the Grand Canyon, at that sort of mind-altering experience into Thunder River before, so that would have introduced you to Flagstaff on the drive up there, is that right?
Yeah, but I didn't pay any attention to Flagstaff.
Okay, but you knew it was up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so in a way, these guys were offering you a way to move closer to the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, that exactly. And, of course, that was one of the big appeals to the thing.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a great appeal to it. And there was a lot of good stuff around Flagstaff anyway, and I was vaguely aware of it, but I didn't know Flagstaff from Adam.
Were you thinking about geology then, or were you still looking, all right, these guys can give me a scholarship, I'm going to go to industrial arts, and I'm going to keep working on my welding and my machining, but I'll be near the Grand Canyon, and there's lots of caves there, so this is sounding good.
Yeah, it's starting to sound like your hobby is coming true, right?
Hmm, okay.
But you know, the thing is, you got in the back of the mind that this stuff is starting to get interesting. So I got up to Flagstaff, and that was a great experience for me. You know what it was a confidence builder. I had a great time up there.
Okay, and, so wait. All right, hang on a second. Let me just check our time. You know what? Peter, we've been at this for not quite an hour. We're about 6 minutes shy. This might be a good time to put a comma in this interview series, and we can pick this up next time when you arrive in Flagstaff, because I want to know what the town was like and you know, what were your first impressions of the campus, and you know, the trains going through town and that whole deal. Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, that's good. And the thing is, I got to Flagstaff at an absolute transition time because the university doubled the enrollment the year I got there. They went from 1,000 to 2,000.
Whoa.
And the sawmill was just shutting down, so I got to see the very last of that. And they were building Glen Canyon Dam, so all the cement trucks were going through there from...
All right, all right. Wait. That's enough. And I got a zillion questions.
No, that was it was an amazing time to be there.
Okay.
And then we also got the Museum of Northern Arizona right up the road, and that was a great plug-in.
Okay, I'm writing this stuff down. Glen Canyon Dam, MNA, the sawmill shutdown. I want to ask you about all this stuff. Sawmill shutdown. Great. Okay. Peter, in the material that we have just covered from back in the day, back in New Jersey, is there anything else you want to add that I haven't asked you about?
Well, you know, nothing. The only thing is, you know, there's details. You never get done with the details. So
yeah.
you got a big picture.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, let's conclude part one of a Grand Canyon oral history interview series with Peter Huntoon. Today is Saturday, September 2nd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Peter, thank you so very much.